Good morning. We call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today's May 12, 2021. The time is 9:02. Silence all cell phones. Present today, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, and Senator Wilson. Today's agenda, SB 130, electronic poll tabs. And first bill up is SB 130. Our intention is to hear an introduction and take public testimony and set the bill aside. Senator Costello, Melody Wilterdink, please come forward and put yourself on the record and start your presentation. And we just like to say, I'd like to thank you, Senator Costello, for finally seeing the light and making the fashion trend statement that you are today to match Senator Wilikowski and myself. With that being said, please introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Good morning, Senator Bishop and members of the Senate Finance Committee. I'm Senator Mia Costello representing West Anchorage, and this morning I'm joined by my legislative aide, Melody Wilterdink. Senate Bill 130 is a committee bill. It's a Senate Labor and Commerce Committee bill. Throughout this session, the committee has been hearing testimony on bills that bring some of our statutes into the 21st century, for example, telehealth, things like that. I see this bill, Mr. Chair, as in line with those bills. It brings an area of our statutes into the 21st century, and what it accomplishes is to add electronic poll tabs as an option for those small businesses that are supporting charities across Alaska by selling poll tabs at their establishments. Mr. Chair, the bill adds the words electronic poll tabs into the statute, and if you're open to it, my aide, Melody Wilterdink, can walk us through the sponsor statement and the sectional.
That'd be fine. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stedman, Co-Chair Bishop, members of the committee. For the record, this is Melody Wilterdink, staff to Senator Costello. So I'll start with the sponsor statement for Senate Bill 130. So traditional paper poll tabs are multi-layered tickets with perforated sections that, when pulled by tearing the perforation, reveal symbols which indicate whether the player has won. When poll tabs in Alaska are used with gaming permits, they're exclusively available to charities. And so that's for fundraising. So these are nonprofit charities around our state, and there are 283 that have poll tab gaming permits here. And they have benefited from receiving donations through these poll tab games. Senate Bill 130 would allow poll tab operators the choice of providing paper poll tabs or electronic poll tabs, which are accessed on site, just like our paper poll tabs are today, typically in a bar or a liquor store. But there are no physical tickets for the operators to count, deface, or store. Benefits of electronic poll tabs include increased security, easier tracking and reporting, and reduced fraud. Modernizing poll tabs makes it less onerous for small businesses to become poll tab operators in support of local charities. I'd be happy to proceed to the sectional analysis.
Please continue.
All right, so section one, which is page one, lines 3 through 8, amends Alaska statute 05.15.690 to insert the phrase "or electronic representation of a card" when describing poll tab games. And then farther down on that same page, page one, lines 9 through 12, section two amends uncodified law to add a new section which would allow the Department of Revenue to adopt the regulations necessary to implement this act. Thank you.
Questions from committee members? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there somewhere else in this title that limits this to a certain location, or electronic representation of a card, for example? Could you pull it up on your iPhone sitting at your house and do pull tabs that way, or is there some limitation somewhere else?
Through the chair, Senator Wielkowski, thank you for your question. For the record, this is Melody Welterdink. So this bill would not change any of the other laws surrounding pull tab games, which right now you have to be a licensed operator or a vendor, and games are played on site. And so introducing electronic pull tab games would mean they would still be played on site, either in a kiosk mechanism or with a tablet device, but it's got to be still typically in that bar where pull tabs are currently played.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Wielkowski?
I mean, the way I look at it, it seems pretty broad. I just want to understand what I'm voting on at some point. You're saying that a person would not be able to go onto their iPhone or Android, whatever, and play outside of the location?
Through the chair, Senator Wielkowski, that is correct. As per our current pull tab laws, that is not allowed, and it would not be under this bill.
Senator Wilson, then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the gaming establishment set the probability on those games? Is that going to be decided by the vendor, or is it set by each pull tab establishment?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, right now the way the pull tab games work, they are a fixed run. So unlike if you're playing a slot machine where you're playing against the machine itself, every single pull is a randomized result. In a pull tab run, there's a certain number of winners always. It's usually about, if you have a $4,000 take, $4,000 worth of tickets, usually about there's $3,000 worth of winnings, and that's for every pull tab game. Now, there won't be 3,000 winners, because some you might win $200, some you might win two, but typically it's about 75% of what originally gets paid in actually gets paid back out.
Follow-up, then Senator Von Imhoff.
Clarify. So is the vendor going to set that rate of the probability of the winning? So let's say the winning percentage, as you say, is going to be about 75%. Is that set by each establishment? So I could say establishment A, they want to have a greater a percentage to the house, so they're going to have a 60% chance of winning, where someone else may feel more generous and set that probability at a higher rate at 80%. I just didn't know how that was going to be set going through. And also, for the record, I think I do have a conflict, because I do own quite a bit of stock in a electronic gaming vendor.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, this is not up to our operators and vendors. So there's several different people in this process. So we have pull tab manufacturers who are licensed in the state. And so it's the people who are actually manufacturing the pull tabs who create the runs and are printing out which ones are winners, which ones are losers. It's my understanding that those regulations are set by the Department of Revenue. We have a couple of people online who might be able to answer that question better. But then after the manufacturers actually make the pull tabs, then they're sold to distributors. And then from the distributors, charities, vendors, they can actually purchase the run. So by the time it gets to being sold in a bar, this decision on how many winners there are was made many steps prior.
Senator Von Imhoff?
So a couple things. Right now, a person can walk into a bar or what have you, open up their wallet, pull out actual cash, and buy the tickets. That way, when the cash runs out, no more tickets. Of course, unless I suppose they do a credit card, but let's just assume it's cash. Now, when they go into this vending machine, I'm assuming they're just going to put in their credit card, and then it's going to be pretty fast. It's going to be like, pull, 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 pull. And their credit card's going to go ding, 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 is my guess. Is there going to be a limit, like, you've just spent $100. You may want to stop now. You've spent $250. Are you sure you can afford this? I mean, is there going to have some type of, like, limit on this?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, for the record, again, this is Melody Welterdink. So this would still be cash. And so how it would work right now, you take your money up to the bartender. You say, I want this many from this box. Sometimes we'll have several different boxes of pull tabs with different payouts. And so it would be the same, except you go up, you give them your cash, they either upload that to the kiosk or they upload it to the tablet, and then they hand you that. And so you would still have to go back to them to say, I want to put this much more on, or I want to get paid out. The difference is that we're not having bartenders hand count 100 pull tabs anymore, and resulting in actually lots of like paper recording of how, who won and who didn't won. There would actually be an electronic record now instead.
Follow up?
Okay, so just to be clear, it's going, the bartender still has to accept the cash, somehow load the, so there is some work of the bartender or whomever it is at this place of location to accept the cash and load on the computer. And then he or she can, the person can choose, to Senator Wilson's choice, the different runs depending on what they feel has been the payout ratio. Well, one of your issues with the bill says we're hoping, we think that this is going to make it, I think your statement, benefits of the electronic pull tab include increased security, easier tracking and reporting, and reduced fraud. In the light of, you know, obviously this dark money cyber attack on oil and gas refinery in the East Coast, the notion of making something electronic, making it safer, more secure, maybe.
Thank you. Any other questions? Go ahead. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at some of the pull tabs in downtown Anchorage, as compared to the pull tabs which are fairly prominent out in the villages, how do you anticipate this is going to be affecting the things that are going out in Scammon Bay or Savunga or places like that?
Through the chair, Senator.
Are they not going to be able to go ahead and, because of poor internet or no internet, not be able to play this way?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. For the record, this is Melody Wilterdink. Thank you for your question. So they'll have the option to do pull tabs or not do pull tabs, so this won't pull them out of that market. I think in some of the more remote areas, this might actually make it easier on charities to participate. It's a closed system inside of the bar, so it's not internet online gaming in the way that buying a raffle ticket online is using the internet. But most importantly, right now, I think outside of the Anchorage area, it's much more difficult to physically go to the pull tab distributor, pick up the pull tabs, and then bring them to the location. And the onus of that is on charities. And so with electronic delivery of these, that might actually make it a little bit easier for them.
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
So if somebody doesn't have internet service, they can't participate in this kind of electronic gaming.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I would ask one of our invited testifiers who actually makes these systems, Scott Henneman.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
It has to do with the demographics of people. It seems like the people that are the least able to afford disposable income are playing the gambling line. How do we protect those people from themselves, those people that are gambling addicts and those people that are less inclined to go ahead and stop when they should have stopped earlier?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I do think that Senator Von Imhoff's point about cash and credit card is an important one here. Again, this would still be paid out in cash, so you're limited to the amount of cash that you have on you.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking through the pull tab statutes and charitable gaming statutes, and I'm just trying to figure out how this is going to work under current statutes. For example, in 05-15-181, there's a requirement that each series of pull tabs manufactured in the state must be sealed and have a serial number label issued by the National Association of Fundraising Ticket Manufacturers. And then if you look at 05-15-185, it says each series of pull tabs distributed in the state must be sealed and have a serial number label. How do you deal with the sealing issue and the serial number labeling issue?
Mr. Senator Wilikowski, I want to apologize to the committee for a second. I want to make aware that Colleen Glover, Director of Tax, is online for questions. Katrina Mitchell, Audit Supervisor for Tax, and then Mr. Scott Henneman, Vice President of Grover Gaming. If this bill sponsor wants to shoot to the lifelines, we're ready to do that, because I have several questions myself to go to those areas. So
Thank you, Senator Bishop, and through the chair, Senator Wielkowski. I would like to refer to the Department of Revenue on this, since the second section of the act does allow them to adopt the regulations necessary to implement this.
Okay, let's go to Senator Wielkowski. I'm going to go to Colleen Glover. She's the director of tax, and see if she heard your question. Ms. Glover?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Did you hear Senator Wielkowski's question, and could you take a stab at that, please?
For the record, Colleen Glover, Tax Division Director, and I think his questions were related to existing statutes that are very specifically written for paper pull tabs. So the department is looking into that and working with departmental law to see how this current draft bill could marry existing statutes. The challenge is for pull tabs. There's a lot of details in statutes for pull tabs, not so much in regulations, which is a little bit different than some of the other games. Some of like raffles, the details around raffles and the rules are in regulation. Pull tabs is very, a lot of details are actually in statute. So I think there will be some need to probably amend legislation or to try to marry the whole idea of electronic pull tab with a paper pull tab. You know, it's my understanding this electronic pull tab is just another potential game type, not a replacement of the paper, and it might be cleaner to have a separate set of statutes just related to electronic pull tabs. For a couple of the points that Senator Wielkowski pointed out about serial numbers and sealing, I mean, there's just provisions in current law that just don't apply to an electronic pull tab.
Thank you. Senator Wielkowski, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. And is there a difference between the definition of a pull tab and a pull tab game?
Ms. Glover, are you able to answer that question?
Through the chair, Senator Wielkowski, in statute, there is only a definition for pull tab game, not a pull tab ticket.
Okay, Ms. Glover, I've got a question for you on as it relates to revenue, and that's what this finance table is interested in, positive revenue. Right now, what tax on charitable gaming is brought in a year to the Treasury?
Church Bishop, currently there is a 3% pull tab tax, and then there's also some associated fees and licenses with all game types. On average, all of those bring in about $2.5 million a year to the state's Treasury.
Okay, and that was $2.5 million a year, if I heard you correctly.
Correct.
From the charitable gaming. Okay. Next is a question is we've heard we have an exhibit A at the Senate Finance table here, and it's a pasteboard box, and it's full of receipts. And it's been mentioned that electronic pull tabs could maybe make it more efficient for the tax division, maybe eliminate some fraud, et cetera. So do you have an estimate? Does revenue have an estimate on how much fraud they think's out there in this area and how much lost revenue the state is not encumbering because of these paper pull tabs?
Chair Bishop, I don't know that we know how much fraud there is, or what we're doing now to better understand the electronic pull tab and how it would impact our management of the Terrible Gaming Program is reaching out to other states who have implemented electronic pull tabs to understand, one, kind of their statutory and regulatory framework for that, and also the impact to them. Is it really more secure? Does it make it easier? Does it make it more complex for the state, for the committees? So those are avenues that we are exploring right now, and we really, you know, this is a new bill that just came out, and so we're really looking into and trying to get good information.
Thank you. Any other questions before I go to invited testimony? We're going to set this bill aside and bring it up next year, but I don't want everybody to forget what we're a year from now, what we're talking about, but we'll come back and do a refresher. So if you would like, I'm going to go to invited testimony, and we're going to go first with Angelina Frazee, Communications Officer, Anchorage Police Department and Employees Association. If you'd put yourself on the record for the committee.
Yes, good morning. This is Angelina Fraze. I am the Communications Officer for the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association. That's just one of the many hats that I wear. I've been in law enforcement for about 20 years, and in the last 5 years, I've committed pretty much my life and career to humanizing police officers and starting a nonprofit. We at the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association have a charitable arm called the Anchorage Cops for Community. Our mission is to not only do great things in the community, but to connect with the community in a positive way and humanize our officers. So we do not have a staff. We do not have a building. We are lucky that the APDEA, the Union of the Police Officers in Anchorage, allows us to use some of their staff and gives us money through their charitable gaming permit. In about the first 3 years we were in operation, we raised close to $100,000 in charitable gaming. And outside of that, we have small fundraisers. The programs that we do, like Shop with a Cop and Firefighter, Project Clothesline, where we raise money and back-to-school supplies for families in need. Just an example for that project, over 2,000 families signed up and stood in line to get back-to-school supplies and interact positively with the police for that event. We do those events all through the year. Coffee with a Cop, I'm hoping some of you have heard of some of them. But in times of financial crisis over the last several years, when nonprofits are hurting and they're doing a lot of government work, as well as COVID hitting us, charitable gaming has been something that we really rely on. So although we're not necessarily directly involved in pull tabs, we do we are involved in charitable gaming. And going electronic, coming into the 21st century, is definitely something I think will help all charities in the state of Alaska continue to do the good business that we do for the state and for our citizens and, for me, for our officers, humanizing them and allowing them to connect positively with the community. So overall, I'm not an expert on this bill, but the more I find out about it, the more I learn about it, I find that the only really downside I can see, so I'm in support of it, would be just competition in gaming. And for us, for the nonprofits, competition is a good thing. It puts more money in our communities for us to do the work that we've seen a lot of loss in revenue coming from the federal side, and then right now with COVID in the community. So I just urge you to learn more about the bill and support it so that we can do more good things in the community. And thank you so much for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Jack Tripp, owner of the Viking in Juneau for over 30 years. Mr. Tripp, can you hear us?
Yes, Senator.
Yes. Please put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name's Jack Tripp, and I own the Viking Lounge for over 32 years. This bill, or a version of this bill, came up about 20 years ago, and I don't know what happened to it. I thought it was a fantastic idea at the time, and I still think it's a fantastic idea. You talk about security. At one point in my business life, due to pull tabs, it almost cost me my business. I took a loss of $94,000 due to theft. And one of the appealing things to me about the electronic style of pull tabs is it took that human element out. And, you know, you loaded it with, I don't know exactly how this version of the bill does, but you loaded it with the 2,000 units or 3,000 units, you know, representing pull tabs, and the people got the same joy out of it, maybe even more because of the electronic aspect of it. And there was no theft, you know. A lot of people don't realize it, but many of these games, you know, if you're lucky, when I was a vendor personally, you might, if everything went good, you might make $90 on that game. So even if you had the best bartenders in the world, if they miscounted some tickets or forgot to collect for them, you know, the $20 or whatever, you might be, just that $20 might be eating nearly 25% of your profit. So it, you take out that element of error, right? Or theft or nefarious people, you know what I mean? Things happen, right? It is time to move towards this. I think other places have done it and been successful at it. And, you know, it's time for Alaska to move in this direction.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I think that is all for invited testimony. We're going to open public testimony, and we're going to go to Mac Miners here in Juneau. Mr. Miners, if you could put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you for letting me testify. I have a lot of experience in the pull tab stuff. And I just want to say that I support Bill 130, and accountability is a big factor. And I do think that if we do have the games, it would probably increase play. That therefore, it would bring more taxes in. And what I want to say is people in gambling always try to get an edge on things. And there has been play, pull tab play, on Facebook, which is totally illegal. And I think that would clean up a lot of the stuff. And the other thing is that I think if you move forward in this, I think what you got to think about is how these terminals or games will be put into the public, as far as whether they go into a bingo parlor, a pull tab parlor, or a bar. I think you're going to run into how those will be put back into play, whether people should be bonded like the operators are, or the vendors where they're just kind of out there. And I think that once you establish the rules for these games, it'll work. And you might think about having a trial period as a test just to see if it's going to work. And the other thing I want to see is that you got to remember that each one of these is its own separate game. And therefore, they have to be played out until you move to the next one. So that means each game is an individual game. And they're made by percentages. And if you're going to be in business to sell people pull tabs, you got to remember that you have to generate the game. Meaning you can't just charge 30 or 40%. You got to give people a chance to win and have fun, because it's more of, it's entertainment. So I want you to keep that in mind as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to go to Willow. Sandy Powers, Big Valley Bingo. 2 minutes, please.
Hi, my name is Sandy Powers. I own Big Valley Bingo in Wasilla. I do believe that this type of technology could be beneficial to Alaska economy, charity, businesses, but we need to make sure that the legislation, as it moves forward, protects our charities, businesses, and benefits the economy. There's a question about whether or not this type of gambling fits within the state limitations on gaming expenses. Currently, our expenses cannot exceed 70% of the adjusted gross income And some of these outside gaming companies propose to take 50% of the revenues immediately out of Alaska economy to their gaming companies. The remaining 50% would not be enough to pay our employees, utilities, landlords, and most importantly, the 30% minimum to the Alaska charities. The vendors, MVPs, and self-directed charities would receive even less. 50% of the revenues is an astounding number to go to these companies that provide these machines. The statutes mentioned before have been addressed that it currently doesn't fit within the current statutes. And one of my other concerns is that some of these outside gaming companies may have a high level of influence on the Department of Revenue Gaming Division to craft the regulations for Alaska without the input of the Alaska legislature or the charities and businesses that will be affected by the regulations. Currently, there are 4 to 5 highly paid out-of-state lobbyists that would like to craft these regulations that would be favorable to their out-of-state casino clients, not the charities, businesses, or the Alaska economy. I do agree with the security of that, with the electronics, in that the play of the game would be less likely to have fraud. But one thing that the businesses need to be aware of, because the play is faster, there will be more winners paid out theoretically throughout the course of the day, so they will have to have more cash on hand, and they need to be prepared to have security to handle that type of cash that they would have to have on hand. And then I just really don't want to see 50% of the revenues leaving the state economy. 50% of the adjusted gross income is just an unbelievable number to me. So with that, I want to thank you for your time, and I would like to be part of the group that might help to craft this to make it more favorable for the Alaskan economy, the charities, and the businesses involved.
Okay, well, thank you. You're welcome, and we appreciate your testimony. I don't see any other one more. We got a new one. Oh, Kathy Fitzgerald, Fairbanks. Please introduce yourself. Put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Fitzgerald. I live in Fairbanks, and I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 130 for the electronic pull tab games for the simple fact that I feel that we are in a entertainment type of an industry where it would increase and bring in a new and younger demographic to the gaming industry. I think the paper pull tabs are almost, I don't want to see them totally go away, but I feel like a electronic source of gaming would be a little more efficient, a lot more available for audit and clarity on some of the reporting. There is currently a need to keep all winners in a paper pull tab game for 3 years, and some entities end up with bags and bags and bags and bags and bags of these things in storage units and things like that, and so that might help eliminate on some of that waste, paper waste, et cetera. But mainly for introducing a new type of entertainment for a new and younger demographic to help increase revenue for the charities. And I would be totally in favor of keeping this within the charitable gaming industry. I do have a concern about, you know, larger places looking more like a gambling casino, which, you know, is not the intent, but to keep that revenue stream coming to the nonprofits. And I also, someone else mentioned something about the illegal gaming that takes place online, and I'm hoping that with increased availability and new types of gaming that that might decrease those online who are using every social media platform available to host and conduct square boards and sell raffles for everything for the purpose of baby shower gifts to funerals. And there's a lot of illegal activity that takes place, so there's absolutely zero enforcement on any of that. There's nothing that's done with the Department of Revenue or local law enforcement. It's considered illegal gambling as opposed to gaming, and the only person who would be liable for something like that as if it were someone with a legitimate permit and conducting those kinds of activities would be enforced for potential loss of that permit based on, you know, illegal types of gaming activities. But other people can do it, deposit money into their personal bank accounts, raise as much as they want, and there is zero enforcement on any of that. So I would hope that with other added alternatives for people to legally do that and support the charities that are risking, you know, going out there, not necessarily risking their permits, but those that are trying to increase their revenues and fund their organizations, I'd like to see more of that money go to that stream as opposed to just in someone's pocket. So, thank you.
Thank you. We've got Senator Wilson, Senator Von Imhoff, and Senator Wilikowski with questions. Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a statement. We heard from this testifier and the first testifier about the online gaming situations. Ms. Glover knows that my office and the Department of Revenue, working with D.C. Barnhill and the state troopers, have been working on this since November to bring awareness to that issue, and the troopers are aware of that situation. And my understanding was that they have been sending out notifications and letters, but, you know, those social media platforms refuse to take it down. We don't have any control over that, but they have been notifying and contacting those Alaskan residents to let them know the statute and taking those criminal proceedings with forth and beginning to press charges on those individuals now.
Thank you for your comments. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I just wanted just to put a little bit of information on the record so both committee members as well as the listening public can sort of understand the magnitude. So looking at 2018, the total gross receipts of gaming was $376 million. So that's how much Alaskans spent in 2018. In 2019, it was $385 million. So we're not talking chump change here. We're talking pretty significant. Of all of that money, in 2019, there were 1,101 permit holders. The majority of the permit holders were 26% were in Anchorage. Fairbanks has about 13%. Southeast is 12%. Chugiak Matsu is 7%. Kenai is 2%. And all other, as in rural Alaska, is 28%. So 28% of the $385 million was coming from rural Alaska for gaming. And this is the same, of course, the senator from Bethel is not here today, but I have a senator here to my left. This money goes to nonprofits, and nonprofits need this money. But at the same time, we also hear that this is the highest sales tax location in the state. Folks are paying quite a bit of money for just goods and services in general, not to mention the high sales tax. The challenge that I see with this bill is creating an easier platform, basically, to take people's money. I'm concerned about that. Thank you.
Public testimony is closed. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I just had a question. I don't know, maybe it's for the Department of Revenue. On the distribution, for a dollar, every dollar, let's say, how much goes to winnings? What percent goes to the bar or whoever is a pull tab organization? And what percent goes to taxes? And then what percent goes to charities?
Ms. Glover, are you still online with us? I see you are. Are you able to answer that?
Colleen Glover for the record. And just to clarify, is this a question just for pull tab games or all gaming in general?
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, just for pull tabs at this point.
Okay. Is Katrina online? Can you walk through those details, Katrina?
Katrina, if you're online, if you can answer that, and if you can't, that's fine. You can get back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, my aide is prepared to answer that question.
And this is Katrina. I'm available.
Okay, Ms. Mitchell.
Okay, for the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Katrina Mitchell. I manage the gaming program for the state of Alaska with the Department of Revenue. If I understand the question correctly, when someone buys a pull tab, what is the distribution of that dollar? So the way it works on maybe a bigger scale is pull tabs are sold. All the sales are called gross receipts. Of the gross receipts that are taken in, prizes need to be paid out. So pull tab games are pre-manufactured. You already know when you buy the game what the potential profit is. So we take the sales in, we pay the prizes out, and what's left is what we call adjusted gross income. Persons that sell pull tab games incur expenses, right? They've got staffing, overhead, cost of games, et cetera. So the way the statute currently reads is no more than 70% of adjusted gross income may go towards paying gaming-related expenses. What's left is 30% of adjusted gross income, or the profit, and in the gaming world we call that net proceeds. And the 30% is the amount of profit that goes to a charity, or to an entity that holds a gaming permit, and then they reinvest those funds into the community. Does that answer your question?
Senator?
Yeah, so of the gross receipts, 70% goes to the pull tab operator in terms of the receipt, or in terms of gaming expenses, and then 30% to charity?
Correct, and the statute requires that in most instances, a minimum of 30% of adjusted gross income will be paid to the organization holding the permit.
Ms. Mitchell, I want to take it one step further. Let's just talk one game in a box, and there's X number of tickets. So can you give me a hypothetical? Because I want to get in my head the number off of one game, the split, the 70-30.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I buy a game from a licensed pull tab manufacturer, okay? So the only entities that can sell pull tabs in the state of Alaska are licensed pull tab manufacturers. They're located outside the state. The only entity that can buy a game from a licensed pull tab manufacturer is a licensed pull tab distributor, and they are required to be physically located in our state. So let's pretend I'm a distributor. I order up the game Bananas. The reason I order up the game Bananas is I see it has a prize payout of about somewhere between 75% and 78%. I buy that game. I know it's popular. I turn around and I sell it to organizations that are authorized to buy pull tab games, which are licensees and permittees under the Charitable Gaming Act. When I sell that game, as a distributor, I'm required by law to collect 3% tax on the ideal net of the game and remit that to the state. But finally, the game gets down to the charity. I put it out on the counter. I put out Bananas on the counter. People buy the game until all the tickets are gone. And we know, and the customer knows, because we've got a flare card that's posted on the wall that tells you exactly, this is how many tickets are in the game, this is how much each ticket costs, these are the total prizes that are going to be paid out, and they're going to be paid out, there's three tabs that'll pay out $300 each, there's 20 tabs that'll pay out $1 each, whatever the prize structure is. And that is how a pull tab game works. Hopefully you understood that.
Oh, I understood all that. So all I want to know is there $1,000 in the box, or can we just use that for a hypothetical? So 70% goes to the house and 30% goes to the charitable gaming. hypothetically.
So the correct, of the money taken in, a minimum of 30% of the adjusted gross income, which is the cash I took in less the prizes I pay out, must be remitted to the charity.
Got it. All right. Senator Costello, did your staff want to make a comment? Miss, are you good?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to have the opportunity to clarify the testimony from Sandy Powers, where she mentioned that 50% of the revenue goes outside of the state's economy. The whole purpose of this is to provide charities across the state of Alaska funds for them to do things, for example, sports teams or whatever charity may exist in your community, whether it's an arts organization or the police department. So I did want to highlight that for the community. Also, in terms of the data that was presented to us from one of the Finance Committee members about the $376 million, this bill deals solely with poll tabs, and that figure is something that my aide can go over if you'd like.
Please, you want to, Ms. Melody, you want to give us the split on the poll tabs versus the aggregate number?
Yes, thank you. To the chair, so for the record, this is Melody Walterdank. So we have the amount of money that the state of Alaska collects from the poll tab tax and the net proceeds fee and the license and permits fee, and that is about $2.7 million. It's a much smaller number when we're talking about just poll tabs. And, of course, this bill only deals with poll tabs. And I'd also, if I could, clarify, so when we're talking about poll tab operators, there's only 19 in the state. These are, you know, a store you would see in the mall that exclusively sells poll tabs. They get 70% of the receipts from that. But when we're talking about vendors, and most poll tab permittees use vendors like bars and liquor stores, they get 30% of the gross then, and the charity gets 70%.
Thank you. Any other questions from the table before we move the bill aside? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just on the gross receipts, the 70%, that's for expenses. Does that include like some kind of a profit for the bar or the pull tab operator? I guess pull tab operator.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, typically for a bar, as mentioned by some of our public testimony, it's a small amount when we're talking about a $4,000 game and $3,000 in winnings that get paid out. You're dealing with $1,000 left, so 700 of that would go to the charity and 300 would go to the bar. But of course, the bar deals with paying the staff time and dealing with actually, you know, dealing out the tickets. And if fraud does occur, say a bartender is counting out 50 tickets and hands out 51, but they only got paid for 50, and that 51st was a $200 winner, the bar bears those losses.
Thank you. Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Grover Gaming is still online, they manufacture both electronic pull tabs and paper, and perhaps could just quickly go over how the tracking is similar to that of the tracking of the paper pull tabs.
Mr. Henneman, are you still with
us? Chairman Bishop. Good morning, Chairman Bishop, members of the Senate Committee. For the record, my name is Scott Henneman, and I am Vice President of Business Development and Governmental Affairs for Grover Gaming, and we're out of Greenville, North Carolina. The manufacturing process that Senator Costello asked about is very similar, if not exact, to the way the manufacturing process is done in paper. The probability that was brought up as a question earlier in the testimony today, or the questions presented by the senator, there is no probability that is outside of the rules and regulations that are set by the Department of Revenue and its charitable gaming division. Now, manufacturers will manufacture various games that have different percentages of payouts, and just like paper, the charities or the distributor who purchases the tickets, both electronic or paper, have a choice of which game, which payout that they want to offer. And again, that's all put in and set by rule. I'd also like to clarify a couple things where there are no credit cards used in any jurisdiction that I'm aware of for charitable gaming in the United States. So we don't want people to gamble off of credit. I'm not sure about Mrs. Powers and her question about the 50%. I know that the 70% that's referenced that charities pay for the operators to be able to operate their business, to be able to purchase the tickets from the manufacturers, that comes out of the 70%. So, and all of those are negotiated and prices are set. So, you know, in states like North Dakota, we sell the tickets, we sell by the ticket just the same way that the pull tab paper tickets are sold. So that's one of the things I wanted to clarify. But from the manufacturing standpoint and the delivery system, it's just a lot more secure. You have no human intervention. That was mentioned. The reporting on these systems are very robust. Every ticket is accounted for. Every penny that goes into a machine is tracked, and reports can be run instantaneously instead of having to wait for reports to be returned via paper or something like that. If there are reports that Alaska has for paper pull tabs, manufacturers can follow that exactly to the T of the forms and format that those reports are done in. So it's pretty streamlined and very transparent all the way through the process.
Thank you. Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you. I guess part of that question would be is, do you guys then sell these machines or do you lease them to those vendors that would perform the pull tab activities?
You know, that is, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, that is set by rule and regulations, but many times machines are provided at no cost to the charity or to the bar. In some cases, they can be leased or they can be purchased, but whoever ends up providing the equipment ends up getting a higher percentage of the revenue. So if it's pushed or to the charity, of course, they won't purchase the equipment. It'll probably be the bar, because I understand that the charities cannot be given a dispensing device. The bars have to buy that. Then those percentages will all be addressed in rule and also negotiated outside of those rules when they're put into place.
Thanks. Senator Von Imhoff, question? Seeing no further questions from the Senator Wilson.
Yes, sorry, I don't have a question for the current speaker, but maybe for the sponsor. Who pays the sales tax to the state? Does that come out of the 30%, or that comes out of the 70%, or I mean, is the charity, or is it coming out of the bar owner's operational costs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson. So I have some answers from the Department of Revenue here, and Colleen or Katrina might be better able to answer this. But so the net proceeds fee, it's 1% of net proceeds of the gross receipts, and I believe those are paid by the permittee, the charity. And then the pull tab tax is 3% of the gross receipts less what was prized for a pull tab game. And so my understanding is that is paid by both, but I would double check with our revenue folks online.
And that's consistent with the fiscal note. You did a wonderful job there. Any other questions from committee members before we set this bill aside? Senator Costello, we appreciate the presentation today. Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda for the Finance Committee is a 1 o'clock meeting today. On the agenda, bills previously heard, and there will be a presentation by Ledge Finance. We are Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before you drop the hammer, just to kind of let people know what's coming. 1 o'clock, we'll have Ledge Finance in front of the committee talking about the cash flow under different dividend scenarios. And also, we have other calls on the Treasury dealing with the economic impact of the COVID virus, and we've got the American Recovery Act buckets we have to set up. We also need to talk about how much we want to try to carry forward to next year. So we'll be refreshing all the numbers at 1 o'clock. That will also include the several different scenarios under a dividend at $500 per person, $1,000 per person, statutory dividend, calculation per person and over the 50-50 split. So we're going to talk about those things. So the dividend range per those watching at home would be the statutory dividend at roughly $3,400 per person, $3,500 somewhere in there, to a 50-50 split of the percentile market value. That'd be about $2,300 per person, to possibly $1,000 dividend per person, or possibly, you know, $500 dividend per person. We have to balance the need for the dividend against and with other needs dealing with the COVID virus monies. The capital budget also will need some funds, so I've asked legislative finance to come before the committee, show us the amount of cash available so we can have the allocation discussion of the different areas that we're going to talk about needing. Again, that's the dividend, economic relief to the citizens with the American Recovery Act money, dealing with the capital budget and dealing with our savings position to carry us forward to next year so we can start refining our position here at the committee and continue the discussion and make some conclusions. So that is scheduled for 1 p.m., Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stedman, how in-depth are we going to get into the PFD amount this afternoon, or is this just more of a cursory presentation that's going to be carried over from what Ledge Finance is going to be giving us?
Chairman, if I could answer that. I think that will be a high-level overview. I just thought it'd be nice if the committee members saw all of the and get a feel for the demand on the Treasury, on the liquidity, excess liquidity that we have, the entire revenue stream, I guess, for FY22, including operations, because there is a finite sum of monies, and we have to make those allocation decisions. So I just thought it'd be good to get the information on the table so committee members can think about it and start formulating their policy position or areas that they want to, or options they want to exclude, and areas they want to maybe possibly include for further, more detailed discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further committee action at the table, we're adjourned. See everybody at 1 o'clock, 10 o'clock, we're adjourned.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order this afternoon, 12th of May, 2021. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Olson, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman. Senator Wilikowski is off to some other meetings, so he won't be joining us today, but he'll have all the information everybody else does here at the table. This afternoon, we're going to have legislative finance come before us and kind of brief us on the cash position, including different scenarios. So I'd like to ask Alexi Painter, Director of Legislative Finance, to come forward. We also have Connor Bell, Legislative Fiscal Analyst. What we're trying to do here is lay down kind of the groundwork of the basic position of the state. We've got most of the operating budget done. It's in its final steps, but we have some components that aren't addressed yet, one of which is a very large one, that's the dividend. And then we have some COVID relief money from the American Recovery Act money we have to deal with. We have a capital budget. But before we all get too excited about any one or all of those, we have a finite amount of funds available before we end up going into the earnings reserve or the permanent fund for an overdraft. And we're having these presentations and working through this informational so the committee and the public, and along with other members in the building, fully understand the cash position of the state so they can make an informed policy decision, whatever that may be, on what they would like to see the American Recovery Act money used on, and the size of the permanent fund dividend. And this will also lead into future discussions on rewriting the dividend formula, because we have the existing statutory formula in one of the slides here also. So it just be a lot of information and background information today. Some of it will be very good. And we'll take input from committee members on alternatives or other scenarios they may want to run or have looked at or would like to look at. So these are just some basic stab in the dark areas. So if I could have Mr. Painter introduce himself for the record, who he represents, along with his trusty aide, that does a lot of the modeling. We'll walk through the slide presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, Director of the Legislative Finance Division.
For the record, this is Connor Bell, Fiscal Analyst with Legislative Finance Division.
And this presentation is fairly similar to one that we did in front of this committee, I think about a month or two ago. Time all runs together at this point in session, but we have some different assumptions now using the Senate budget that's in before this committee, as well as updated permanent fund returns. So we have updated some of the information in this presentation. So our usual disclaimer that the scenarios and adjustments here were requested by the finance chairs, and they were not endorsing any particular fiscal plans by their inclusion. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Bell to talk about our modeling assumptions.
For the record, this is Connor Bell. This slide highlights the assumptions we're using in the modeling outputs we'll be showing in future slides. First off, we're using Department of Revenue spring forecast, which is assuming $53 per barrel oil in FY21 and $61 per barrel oil in FY22. We're on track to meet that or be around that $53 per barrel average in FY21. So far, for the first 10 months, we're at about, we're about at $51 per barrel for the first 10 months. And so if we average about $63 or $64 in the last 2 months of the year, then we would hit that $53 per barrel amount. Significant change from the last time we presented to this committee is that we are using the permanent fund's actual income through March 31st. And the last time we presented these this specific presentation outlining various fiscal models. And basically that is a return rate of 21.75% total return. And We are also assuming for realized return the year to date as of March 31st, and then we assume an additional $350 million in realized returns in the fourth quarter due to more reliable and less volatile interest and rental income. And so that's a significant departure from Callan's updated forecast of 13.89%. Going forward, after FY21, we're returning to the updated Callan forecast of 6.2% per year of total returns, and that does not, this is not an official forecast. Basically, we are just varying 1 year, and so with that caveat that we're not, you know, the 6.2% that Callan provided was based on a different assumption, FY21. So this is not basically based on anything specific. I guess, I apologize, but it's not tracking exactly what Callan provided. As well, we're assuming no inflation proofing for FY21 through FY24, and that's due to the legislative intent behind the large transfer in FY20. Beginning FY25, there's about $1 billion per year of inflation proofing. And if you see the graphs, that earnings reserves start to decline around FY25, it's maybe because of that increased inflation proofing to the principal. We're also assuming $50 million per year in supplementals, 2% inflation growth, as well as any deficits are first being filled with the constitutional budget reserve, but we leave a minimum balance for the constitutional budget reserve of $500 million, at which point deficits are filled with the earnings reserve. We're happy to provide any additional scenarios for legislative offices. Just let me know if you have anything you'd like me to model, and we also have a simpler four-year model that we can provide directly to legislators upon request.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get a better understanding of this assumption of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation will realize the additional $350 million. Is that a low, medium, high estimate, or how accurate is that estimate, or do you expect that to be higher?
We believe that's a conservative, through the chair, Senator Wilson. We believe that that's a conservative assumption. Basically, even in absence of any gains in the stock market, they have these income sources like rental income and things like that that are relatively reliable and consistent. So yes, we believe that 350 is conservative and may well be above that amount.
Okay, next slide, please.
This slide looks at the growth in revenues over the forecast period, and in essence, this slide is showing that through the years of the forecast period, the revenue outpaces inflation. And so since we're assuming that the operating budget, the agency operating budget grows with inflation, the revenues are outpacing that, and so the deficits tend to decrease in the later years. As far as the POMV draw, that 21.75% return in FY21 leads to significantly higher POMV draws, and the percent of market value draw is 5% of the five-year average fund balance after subtracting the AMHES account. And since it's a trailing average, the FY21 balance does not affect the FY22 draw, and that's why you see the delayed effect. And so that leads to significantly more POMV revenue. In addition, the spring forecast shows rapid revenue growth in FY23 through FY25. Part of that is due to basically rebounding from the pandemic. For instance, the non-oil corporate income tax is up $120 million approximately from FY22 to FY23. And the oil and gas corporate income tax is up about $85 million from 22 to 23. And some of that is because of the CARES Act provisions in the federal tax law that affect the state corporate income tax liability, but not necessarily all of it.
Next slide.
And for the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance. So this fiscal summary is very similar to one that I presented in this committee a week ago. And this reflects the first committee substitute of for the Senate operating budget. So the numbers on line 7 show the agency operations. Line 8 are the statewide items in the Senate committee substitute for the operating budget. The capital budget assumption here is one that we, not the same as we used last week, but one that we had used previously in this in a similar presentation. This is essentially the governor's capital budget with UGF in place of some non-UGF sources that he had used, particularly the AHFC bonds and overspending the PCE program or fund beyond the statutory amount, and utilizing the Mental Health Trust Reserve fund. So this just puts UGF in place of all those items. And so with this kind of baseline capital budget, the bottom line is a deficit before paying a dividend of about $18.9 million, so roughly a balanced budget without paying a dividend. And so as we go into these scenarios, that's kind of our baseline, and then we'll be showing different dividend scenarios based on this budget baseline. And a reminder of the reserve balances. Again, this is a slide that you saw last week. The Senate committee substitute reconstitutes the statutory budget reserve as well as utilizes some of the existing balance in the constitutional budget reserve. And really, I think the important number is to kind of add these two up. And at the end of fiscal year 21, we have just over $1 billion in reserves. And so that's kind of our baseline number going forward for these models, is about $1 billion in reserves as our starting point.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I know in the past we've looked at the reserves and like how the CBR and the general fund kind of interact as the money comes in throughout the year with taxes. There's like, it's like a working capital line of credit almost. It kind of goes up and down and up and down. And that a midline was between 400 or 500 or 600 million. But that's like if everything goes well. I think, Mr. Chairman, what we've seen in the past is if there's a fall in oil prices or if there's a fall in oil volume, sometimes we need that a little bit more of a cushion in the CBR. So hence, I think the $1 billion is sort of about right, because it's not only for in the event that we have a wildfire, in the event that we have a earthquake, which we're still digging out of a hole for in the last couple summers. So I appreciate Mr. Painter stating that $1 billion is about the base number.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay, so going on to slide 7. So this is, again, showing no PFD, and the difference in the deficit number here in FY22 is due to our assumption of supplementals of $50 million for future, as yet, unidentified items. We're assuming in this version constant 6.2% returns. And you can see that the effect of what Mr. Bell spoke about with the rising revenue, that we go from a $69 million deficit in FY22 to a $345 million surplus in FY23, and then rising throughout the period. And so I think it's important just to have this baseline, because as we go through other scenarios, it looks like, you know, in every scenario, we have a much larger deficit in the early years than in the later years. And so every plan kind of looks like it fixes the problem, but really that's reflecting the assumptions that revenue will grow faster than inflation over this period. And that leads to every scenario just improving rapidly over the next few years.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So again, the revenue down below in the blue is our resource revenue, like oil and minerals and so forth. And we're assuming here that they're all going up. But we know that sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. And the other thing is what is your, maybe you may have stated this, but what's the capital assumption for the capital spend on this model?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, this model assumes the $176.7 million capital budget, I believe growing with inflation. Yes, growing with inflation. And I think we recognize that reflects sort of a bare minimum capital budget. You know, we've had discussions at this committee table over the last several years about what level of spending we would need to do to keep up with deferred maintenance, and it's probably higher than that, but that's been 176 is actually a little higher than our capital budgets have been over the last few years.
Senator Bishop, you want to ask about the coming infrastructure impact?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this doesn't assume that whatever passes out of the next Congress from an infrastructure standpoint, if there's going to be any UGF match for the increase in federal dollars that we might be getting. This is just a status quo capital budget with inflation. So we could be having an additional UGF increase in our capital budget. I just want to make that point on the record.
Any other questions on the base model? Okay, next slide, please.
So the next slide, slide 8, shows the same base assumptions, except now instead of the constant 6.2% returns, we're using the actual permanent fund earnings between FY 2000 and 2008. So just a reminder of the ancient history back then, in FY 2000 through 2002, we had a relatively mild recession, the dot-com bust, that caused decreased returns in the permanent fund for a couple of years and less realized income for several years after that. And then there were fairly strong years in the mid-2000s before the 2008 recession that you see just barely beginning to impact in the last year there. And during this period, the mean returns over that period is actually slightly higher than the 6.2%, but because of the recession in the early years, you can see that the reserve balances and the deficits are actually a little larger than in the 6.2% assumption. So the timing of those, the sequence of the returns matters quite a bit. And so in this scenario, you can see that instead of our reserves being, you know, just a straight line, the ERA would dip down over the next few years and then begin to rebound. And the deficit would still shrink rapidly, but not quite as rapidly in the last scenario. Just as a reminder, going back to the last one, by FY30, the surplus was 1480, and this one's 1066. So just that difference in the timing of the returns makes something like a $400 million difference in our deficit, or our surplus in this case, in the assumption. So it just kind of illustrates how sensitive the model is to changes in assumptions with adding volatility.
Okay, next slide.
Slide 9 shows further volatility. This is FY 09 through 17. That incorporates the worst year in the fund's history, fiscal year 2009, the only year that we've realized a loss in the earnings reserve. And while the following years were fairly strong, you can see on the right-hand side that the ERA still doesn't really recover, and this is without any overdraws. But because the returns in this scenario overall are a little higher, the surplus in FY30 is actually a little larger than the last scenario, but the ERA is much less healthy as a result of the extreme volatility in this scenario.
And just for those, before we go on to this next slide, there are several scenarios here, all of which are followed up by the two different market return scenarios, actual returns in the past. So this model would trying to give committee members a feel for the nonlinear financial markets. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So just to review, the POMV is the green on the left side, the actual draw, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, that's correct.
So even though the earnings reserve account in this stress test here really went down, the POMV, according to this, was sort of flattened over time. It was still sort of consistent, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, because the averaging of the POMV, even with the volatility here, it ends up being a fairly smooth amount.
Thank you.
Okay. Slide number 10, please.
So slide number 10, we're showing the statutory permanent fund dividend. So this shows that the deficit in FY22 would be $2.3 billion. And if you recall a presentation, I believe last Friday, about the size of the statutory permanent fund dividend, that amount has gone up a little bit since our the governor's budget was introduced in December. It's a little higher because of the higher returns in FY21 mean that the dividend would be larger. And so you can see that in this scenario, the CBR is not enough to meet our deficits. We have deficits starting at $2.3 billion, shrinking over time to about $1.3 billion. But additional draws from the ERA are necessary to balance the budget. Sorry. On the bottom, you can see the effective POMV rate. So, you know, if these overdraws were converted into POMV terms, how big would that be? You could see that our draws would be over 8% in some years and shrinking, and still over 6 or 7%. The result on the right, you can see these green bars get smaller and smaller, and the ERA practically vanishes by FY30 in this scenario.
So if we pay out the $3,485 dividend, I think it was one of the targeted amounts this year, you're telling the committee that the FY22 draw would be most likely 8.23%, roughly, which is substantially higher than the 5 on the permanent fund. Is that how you read this chart?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And then the FY22 negative up on top, it says negative $2,334,000,000. What is that number?
Mr. Chairman, that would be our deficit in the current fiscal year.
After the dividend?
Correct.
But before additive to the permanent or capital budget, if we increase that over the 170. Okay. And then has there ever been a period of growth of the permanent fund? Looking at on the right-hand side of the chart, it looks like you have the principal and the ERA, purple and green. Has there been a, do you recall a decade like that where the permanent fund actually went backwards?
Mr. Chairman, we've not had a period where the permanent fund has gone down for more than a year or two at a time.
Okay. So we have any other questions on this one? Next slide, please. Slide 11.
So the next slide shows the same statutory dividend, except this time with the actual returns from fiscal year 2000 through 2008. And there's a couple of things to note about this. One is you can see the dotted line that reflects the budget with the dividend. It actually goes down. That's because the current statute, because it's based on earnings, is actually fairly volatile. And so the effect of having the poor return years in these early years is a reduced dividend, which is actually what we saw during this period when we lived through fiscal year 2000 through 2008. Dividends shrunk substantially during that period. So as a result, the overdraws are actually not as big as in that last scenario because the dividend is smaller. However, we still would have that 8.23% effective draw in the first year and large overdraws every year, but the actual deficit would be a little smaller. You can see that the ERA does just barely survive through this scenario, but in some years it's down to essentially nothing after paying the amount needed to fill the deficits.
Okay. Next slide.
So going on to the next slide, we have what we would call a broken model in a couple of years. So in 3 years in this model, FY25, 26, and 30, there's a gap between this dotted line and our revenue to meet it, meaning that even after drawing out of the constitutional budget reserve down to zero, and even after drawing the ERA down to zero, we would not have sufficient reserves to meet the budget. And this is despite, again, the statutory dividend shrinking over this period because of the formula. These overdraws are still large enough combined with the losses that would run the ERA out and lead to no funding to pay for government. And so in several of these years, you see that there's no ERA balance left on the right side.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Painter, when you talk about a broken model in the out years, not enough money to fund government, but also
would there be no funding to pay a dividend either?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
The other thing that kind of sticks out, Mr. Painter, you look at the bottom, you got the draw rate on the permanent fund. It looks like if you do an overdraw a couple of times, you can get in trouble pretty fast.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, especially when coupled with negative realized income that we experienced in FY09. That plus overdraws plus the regular POMV draw can combine to drain the ERA very quickly.
So then, of course, at the top there, you have the surplus deficit. And so next year, it would be $2.3 billion deficit, then a $1.025 billion deficit and so forth. It kind of goes down a little bit, and then, well, as a smaller deficit, and then it goes right back up again, depending on if we have some poor returns in this model. So we obviously would have to fill it with something. Either the ad hoc draws or taxes. And so is there such thing as a model just as like what it would be to take that much in taxes from our working Alaskans?
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I don't think there would be a single model. It depends on which tax source you would choose, whether it be an income tax, sales tax, combination of excise taxes. The economic impact would vary depending on what option you chose or found budget reductions or other sources. I think this committee had ICER's modeling in front of them that I think is kind of the gold standard for the economic effect of these various options.
I wouldn't necessarily call ICER's model the gold standard, but I think that's just an opinion. At one point, if we're going to go down this road, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important for us to start modeling the economic impact of these various different taxes on working Alaskans. So that's something that we should probably start looking to see how we do that.
Okay. Next page, please. Slide 13.
The next slide, slide 13, shows the effect of the dividend that is equal to 50% of the percent of market value draw. So that would be a dividend of somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,400 in FY22. And this dividend level leaves substantial deficits. So in FY22, that'd be a $1.6 billion deficit, shrinking down to somewhere in the $700-$800 range by or $800 million range, sorry, by FY30, and requiring overdraws, so a 7% effective POMV in FY22 and so on, all nearly 6% or above. And then that leads to a declining earnings reserve account balance, as you can see here, and the fund just barely growing, so going from $75 billion to $80 billion over the course of a decade, so it's not keeping up with inflation. And the ERA balance is shrinking in this model.
So those watching at home, the previous slides were on the existing formula. We see quite a bit in the media the last few years as we've struggled with our structural fiscal deficit. This 50% of market value is taking one half of the 5% draw to the dividend. It's 50% of the draw of the permanent fund to the dividend, the other 50% to the operations of the state. So we are pointing out to the committee this year, next year, 22, the budget we're working on now, and 23, the budget we're going to work on next winter, would be somewhere around $1.6 billion underwater this year and $1.3 billion next year, so about $1.5 billion per year averaged out that we'd have to come up with other revenue.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That's essentially, $2.9 billion in combined deficits over the next 2 years that would have to be made up with some combination of either, draws from some reserve source or new revenue or budget reductions.
So if we set aside $3 billion into the CBR to cushion us through those years and we have everything combined within the constitutionally protected portion, and we have the portfolio then capped at a 5% draw, So it looks like then in 24 we'd be underwater about 1.1 billion or some number like in that range. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If we just took that $3 billion and spent it and did not, you know, use that time to make some sort of structural change in our fiscal situation, then we would go into FY24 with that size gap.
The structural change would have to be increased revenue or decreased expenditures. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And the decreased expenditures, just for those watching at home, we've gone through two governors, three legislatures, I think, or four legislatures that have been unable to move the, make any significant movement within the operational budget, unrestricted general funds of the state. We've had that chart on this table several times, including the budget year we're working in right now is pretty flat. So we've got about 5 years of horizontal. What reductions we've been able to attain, Marine Highway and University, we've lost in corrections in other areas, debt service, pension payments, those sorts of things. So with 5 year track record of unable to move those expenditures down, it looks to me like what we'd be staring into is a much higher probability of taxes, income tax, sales tax, or some form of taxes to create roughly $1 billion. Is that fairly close to what I should be taking from this slide?
Mr. Chairman, I can't really, as a nonpartisan person, comment on, you know, the political viability of cuts, but just to kind of put that in perspective, you know, the Senate version of the operating budget is something around $4.5 billion. So the $1.5 billion deficit is about a third of the budget. So if you're trying to meet that with reductions alone, you'd have to reduce the budget by a third. The state's total budget is already down 43% from the peak. So you have to get another third of the budget to get down to do that with cuts alone. So it would be extremely difficult and likely impossible to completely close that deficit with cuts alone.
So I recognize you're nonpartisan, which is good. But is that an accurate statement I made for the last 5 years? The general unrestricted general funds have been horizontal across the totals of the agencies, legislature, courts, and the governor's office, and then we include statewide debt service and pension payments?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's accurate. Our current budget is very comparable to the budget in fiscal year 18, for example.
Okay. So just want to drill that home, that point home, for those that respond that just cut the budget, that we've had two different governors from different areas of the political spectrum. We've had, I'll have to go back and look, three or four different legislatures with their fingers in the pie, unable to deliver these reductions for various reasons. So that leads me to conclude the only viable option is taxes, revenue enhancements of some form. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I believe, Mr. Chairman, is this the proposal that our governor just presented in the press conference today with a 50-50 POMV split?
I didn't attend his press conference, but if he was proposing a 50-50 at 5%, I'd say these numbers are pretty much in the ballpark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's what he was proposing, and it shows here in fiscal year 22, 23, 24, like you were pointing out, a significant deficit. And interesting, the governor's Department of Revenue and as well as the Tax Foundation did a modeling of taxes of this scenario, I think, a while back. And these magnitudes of $1.5 billion are so big that it would probably take a combination of taxes. And I believe that these organizations modeled an income tax and a sales tax, as it would take both, as well as potentially a change in oil taxes. It would take all three to fill this magnitude. And I think their response was families would be paying thousands of dollars in taxes both in sales and income combined, in order to make up this magnitude. It was startling.
Yeah, we'll probably be more. We will be looking at that at some point when we take a look at this. I think even if the 1.3 billion in 23 is incorrect, negative, if it was off 300 million, you're still a billion underwater. So just to gauge the sensitivity of it. The other thing that I find very alarming is if you look at the bottom and you look at the percentage draw on your permanent fund and those percentages, that is alarming to me to have that magnitude of an overdraw. If we can go on to the next slide, I think we can. Oh, the other thing I'd like to note here is the flat growth on the right-hand side of the permanent fund going forward. We slowly get it from the mid-70s to up to 80 billion. But if we could get that portfolio up to 100 billion and having it spinning off less than 5%, 4.5 or 4.75 or some number, we would be sitting in a completely opposite position at this table, and we would be dealing with deferred maintenance and actually infrastructure construction in cash with the dividend and no taxes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff and then Senator Bishop.
Just my last comment, because you did highlight the potential draw rate at the bottom there, and it's definitely over 5%. And I think that this committee has heard me say before that traditionally foundations and endowments and sovereign wealth funds do best at a consistent 5% draw, no more than that. And that has been tested over time. And that with the world markets and the global equity markets and financial instruments that are available now for investment, that any draw over 5% generally cannot maintain inflation and generally erodes its value over time, which is what we're seeing here.
Senator Bishop.
Just a comment. Several years ago when we were looking at an income tax bill from the former administration, you know, as hard as we're working trying to right-size government and get there, and that includes eliminating PCNs, you're going to be adding PCNs to the Department of Revenue if you're looking at an income tax.
Let's take a look at what this is going to look like. These other proposals also that are coming, this is just one of them. There's several here. Let's take a look at it. When we get away from this linear extrapolation of financial markets, and anybody that paid any attention to the financial markets will know it is not a linear progression from year to year or decade to decade. And we've been cautioned by the consultants of the permanent fund that the projected returns for the next 10 years are lower than the last decade. The decade we're leaving now, that has been very robust to our growth, they're lowering those projections, and we'll see that in the permanent fund projections, and we'll see it in our pension projections here at the table. So we need to, I think, consider that extrapolation and impacts in here. So if you could go on to slide 14 and talk about the financial markets from 2000 through 2008, what this would 50-50 would look like.
Mr. Chairman, on slide 14, this is the 50-50 with 2000 through 2008 actual returns. And so on the right, just looking at the health of the reserves, you can see that the earnings reserve account shrinks substantially, starts to rebound with the strong markets in those a few years there, and then shrinks again. The deficits are start at $1.6 billion and then $1.3 and shrink a little bit, but still about a billion or so at least every year. And the overdraws, again, are 6.5% or higher pretty much every year to make the budget during this period. And so, again, compared to the last scenario, when you add volatility in, you do see a smaller amount in the ERA from the overdraws and the reduced earnings in some of these years.
Okay.
one to the other set.
Going on to slide 15, we have another broken model. This one's actually a little worse than the statutory dividend because with the statutory dividend, after that really bad market year, the dividend goes down substantially, but the POMV-based dividend stays relatively flat. And so we still have in FY 25 and 26 a substantial gap between reserves and revenue and then the budget. And then the ERA rebounds a bit and then is gone again by FY 30. So you can see the deficits here are comparable to the last slide, around 1.2 billion in so many of the out years and then shrinking in the last few years. And there's essentially no earnings reserve to speak of after FY 24 in this scenario.
Okay. I think also just as a note, we're not doing direct comparisons yet, but if we were to roll in the corpus into the earnings reserve, put it in the Constitution by blending them together, the negative volatility wouldn't block us from extracting 5% because we'd take 5% if that's the rate over the average of the previous years. The earnings reserve would no longer exist. So we wouldn't be in a position where we couldn't get to 5% and adverse market conditions. So we'll have to, when we look at that proposed concept of rolling the earnings reserve into the corpus, we'll have to adjust some of these slides for that very thing. In other words, you could have a 10-year declining market and your payout is going to still be 5% of the trailing average, even on a downward slope. So you could possibly erode into what we commonly call a principal portion in the short run. So there's some tweaking we'll have to do, but it won't erase the $1 billion roughly hole that we have to replace. And that's about 4,700 for every man, woman, and child in the state.
Chairman, moving on to slide 16, this shows the budget with a $1,000 PFD going back to the constant 6.2% returns. So in this scenario, there's a deficit in FY22 of $744 million, then shrinking to $334 and reaching a surplus in FY25 as the revenue is projected to grow faster than inflation. So this does eventually have a surplus of $700 million by FY30. And so there are overdraws in these first couple of years. So FY22 through 24 would require overdraws in this scenario. Excuse me. And so that does slightly erode the balance of the ERA, but since they're relatively small, it's hard to see that on the graph. And the ERA balance itself is actually pretty healthy in this scenario, despite the overdraws in the early years.
So I want to correct my stepping on my tongue. It's not 4,000, it's $1,580 or $1,600 per person in the state on $1 billion. To give you an idea how big the hole is for every man, woman, and child, if we're $1 billion under water, that's a significant amount of money. So, go ahead and continue.
No questions on that. Moving on to the FY 2000 through 2008 returns. And so similar with a lot of these 2000 through 2008 scenarios, we start with the same size deficit, $744 million. It shrinks, and still in FY26, that's the year we'd go to surpluses, but they're smaller than in the last scenario, $319 million by FY30. And you can see that in this scenario, the ERA is still pretty healthy throughout the entire period. Because while there are some overdraws in FY22 through 24, they're relatively small. Going on to the FY09 through 17 returns, this one, because of the large negative market in the first year, the overdraws actually persist from FY22 through 28, so quite a long period. But again, they're fairly minimal, in the range of about another 0.5% of the percent of market value draw. that's kind of minimal in the, you know, compared to the PMV draw, but that's actually several hundred million dollars per year in some of these years. And a result of these overdraws and the negative market performance is that the ERA essentially vanishes, but we don't ever have a broken model in this scenario. There's enough in the ERA to balance the budget, but just barely. And so in some of these years, really the ERA balance does not recover in this scenario, despite the overdraws being relatively small.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. So like in, let's go fiscal year 25, you have a POMV and denoted in the green on the left, but then you have an ERA that's hardly nothing there. Is there enough there to pay this POMV draw?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there is. So that ERA balance that you see there is after paying the POMV draw and paying the overdraw, that's the red bar. So there's enough to make it, but it's very close. You can see there's a little bit of green there, but essentially nothing.
And one last. So then we, if you look at it for fiscal year 21, the whole combined amount is roughly $75 million, and it takes us almost almost 8 to 9 years to get back to that. Like, we lose ground these next several years under this scenario.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Senator Bishop.
Mr. Painter, let's just stay on fiscal year 25. Senator Von Imhoff identified, and you go up to the surplus deficit and a surplus of $37 million on the top line.
Through the chair, I think in FY 25, we see a deficit of $274 million.
Well, I'm back a page, but let's just go back one page to 17, if you could, just for a moment. The point I want to make is, without any new revenue, a surplus of $37 million, if we have a supplemental budget in the following year, we have no funds to cover it without another overdraw.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And I think given, you know, the imprecise nature of the modeling, anything within $100 million either way is roughly close enough to balance, well within the margin of error of our modeling.
Just another point, just to clarify things. If we have 250,000 workers in the state paying income tax, they'd have to pay $4,000 roughly a piece to make $1 billion. But not every man, woman, and child is going to be paying taxes, only the people that are working on an income tax. And then everybody gets to pay a sales tax. So it's a significant tax coming down the discussion of the table.
Going on to slide 19, this shows a $750 PFD with the constant returns. And so in contrast to the last scenario, this one, there's only 2 years of overdraws. I think the last one had three, with a balanced budget starting in FY24. And so you have a deficit of $584 million in FY22 and turning to a surplus in FY24, and that surplus rising to over $900 million by FY30. So there are some overdraws here, but they're, you know, relatively small and allow the ERA to grow throughout this scenario. So you can see the combined balance of the permit fund is nearly $90 billion by FY30.
Next slide, please.
And then going on to slide 20, so this is with the 2000 through 2008 returns, again, a $750 dividend, very similar to the last one where we have deficits in the first 2 years and then surpluses in following years, and a relatively healthy ERA still ending with the total permanent fund balance of nearly $90 billion by the end of the period. And going on to slide 21, again to the 09 through 17 returns, and once again the deficits persist longer in this scenario, so the overdraws continue through FY26 and the deficits go through FY26 as well, before turning into a balanced budget in FY27 and then surpluses in the last couple of years. And you can see that the overdraws are small enough that there's still an ERA left in each year, but still not very much of one. And finally, last scenario here is the $500 PFD, which has a $424 million deficit in FY22, essentially a balanced budget in FY23, and then surpluses in the following years. We're showing in our modeling that that would require a very small overdraw in FY22. In reality, I think given the flexibility in the budget, you know, this is within the margin of error that we can probably reach without an overdraw. And so this overdraw that's shown doesn't really impact the ERA balance, and you see the growing ERA, growing permanent fund throughout this period. Going on to slide 23, again, $500 dividend with the FY 2000 through 2008 returns. So very similar in terms of the deficits with the small overdraw in the first year and small deficit or a deficit of $424 million in FY22, and then roughly balanced beyond and then turning into a surplus, again, with a growing permanent fund because of the lack of overdraws.
So in 2030, 2029 under this scenario, which isn't going to happen because we don't have a $500 dividend and we can't go back in time to 2000 and 2008 to get these returns. So it's hypothetical. But here your portfolio is sitting at almost $100 billion. And then there must have been a big drunken brawl or party what went on the following year to have it go down. FY30.
Mr. Chairman, that FY30 is the equivalent of 2008, which, you know, was the first half of the Great Recession. So if we live through this again, hopefully we wouldn't have another recession of that size.
Wouldn't get excited to hit $100 million and then peel back. So, but anyway, it's just to show that, well, hopefully I'm still kicking my rocking chair when that hits $100 million. I'd like to see the day. Senator Von Imhoff.
So, Mr. Chairman, let's actually just go to the next slide because I think that's kind of case in point. So if Mr. Painter could explain the slide, and then I'll ask my question.
Sure. So slide 24 shows the FY09 through 17 returns of the $500 dividend, that familiar $424 million deficit in FY22, and then balanced budgets for the next few years turning into surpluses in the later years. So despite the volatility, because of just the one little overdraw, essentially we do keep an ERA through this period and the permanent fund is able to grow once it recovers from the large drop in that first year.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does show, as Mr. Painter just said, large drop in the first year, and it takes like 8 to 9 years to even remotely get back to where we are now. I mean, it's a big clawback. And what's happening is we are looking at the last, I guess, 12 months of a good market rebound, but it's overheating. And I think I've mentioned this before, you know, these returns can't continue over time because inflation tends to outstrip or tends to become a problem. And we're, if you read the financial returns, that's what they're saying right now. So it's the returns that we're having now will probably be checked pretty severely by the federal government here, if the economists are correct. So we're going to see probably something a little bit more in the lines of a rebalance.
Okay, we're on to slide number 25.
So slide number 25, switching gears to this is showing the impacts of a single overdraw in fiscal year 22, showing what would happen if we pulled out the amount in FY22 equal to the statutory dividend. And so just that one overdraw and then following the PMV in out years would have a lasting effect on both the ERA balances, which you see in the graph. The left in the blue bars, you see the ERA balance if we follow POMV. So as Mr. Bell said earlier, you see the rising over the first few years, and then as inflation proofing returns, it's a slight decline. If we draw that $2.2 billion out in FY22, you'd see a decline in FY22. It would rise again, but end up still above $17 billion, but not above the $20 billion that in the no overdraw scenario. I think the more dramatic effect is really the percent of market value draw. So because of the averaging and the delay, you don't see an impact in that POMV draw until FY24. And then it takes several years for that to fully work its way through the average. So you see that impact grows year by year until by FY28, just that single overdraw would increase the deficit by $125.7 million. And over this period through FY30, that single overdraw would cumulatively increase the deficits that we would have to fill some other way by $632 million.
Senator Bishop, isn't the base number for the capital budget somewhere around $127 million before we add other things on it?
Bare bones, yes.
Yeah, bare bones, mm-hmm. Just federal match.
Yes.
So what we're talking about here is the equivalency of a one-year federal match capital budget dealing with all our airports and all our roads all across the state. So it's significant.
Then slide 26 shows, again, that single overdraw with the actual 2000 through 2008 returns. So in the blue bars, you can see that the ERA would decline even without the overdraws. With the overdraws, it would get down below $10 billion for a three-year period. And the impact in the POMV draw is a little less dramatic because of the lower returns, but still nearly a $120 million impact by FY30, and cumulatively $566 million less brought in POMV over this period that have to be made up from another source. Okay. And finally, the same thing with the 09 through 17 returns. And here you see again, in the blue, the very dramatic reduction in the ERA that would happen if you had the large single year drop as we experienced in FY09. And then the ERA would drop again with the, I think we had a negative return or a very flat return one of these years. And so the ERA without an overdraw drops to about $2 billion and barely recovers. With the overdraw, it actually goes to zero in FY25. So even without these ongoing overdraws that we saw in some of these other slides, just a single overdraw, if we had the sort of experience we had from 09 to 17, could cause the ERA to vanish. And the impact here on the POMV draws is even more dramatic than the last couple of slides. $164.7 million per year by FY30, cumulatively over $700 million over this period.
Any other questions? There was another slide I don't think we have here, but I've had Mr. Painter run a forward projection of the dividend growth. We've talked about dividends. We know what the historical dividends were. So we'll have him put it in a format. Ledge Finance can put the statutory dividend, currently the 50-50 split dividend at 5%, in a document for us and run it out to 30 years, I guess, in the future, and use historical returns and use Callan's projected returns for the next decade at 6.2, historic returns 8.6, you'll see that the dividend on a 50-50 plan would go from roughly $2,354 in 10 years, it'd be $5,400. In 20 years, if it's a historical returns 8.6, it'd be $12,000 per man, woman, and child, 20 years. And then if Callan's projections are accurate for two decades, which we'd be lucky if they're accurate for one decade, and those returns are a full 2% or 25% lower than the historical last 30, 40 years, now your dividend will be at from $2,300 to $4,300. That's $2,300 to $4,300 in 10 years, and then on up to $7,800. So we might want to give some thought on what things are going to look like a couple of decades out, because the original dividend formula that was put in place 40 years ago worked good for several decades. And now it's problematic because of the financial markets exceed the growth of those, the portfolio exceed inflation and purchasing power.
And when we start taking a look at it in multiple decade steps, it would be nice when we put a formula together that it'll stand the test of time for at least 3 or 4 decades. But there's significant growth in the, not only the dividend, but in the permanent fund going forward. But just remember, it's as hard to turn $10,000 as it is to 20 as it is to turn 50 billion into 100 billion. Or 80 billion, or 75 billion where we're at now, to 150 billion. So don't assume that 80, 75 or 80 billion is a big number. The permanent fund is still very young, and it's going to be staggering when the upcoming newborn baby in the finance room coming is 30 and 40 years old and looks back at this meeting when his or her mama was pregnant, sitting in Senate Finance talking about the future value of the permanent fund and the dividends. I hope that actually takes place sometime. It would be a pretty interesting conversation around the dinner table. So with that, if there's any other final comments, let's set the future generations up better than they set us up. Let's not make any mistakes here the next 2 years. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., Finance, I'm going to have a brief at ease for a consultation with Senator Bishop on what's coming up tomorrow. We're at ease. Back on the record, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., things are a little bit in flux. Senator Bishop has an education bill I think he might put on the table. We're waiting for another CS in the operating budget, maybe available in the afternoon. As soon as it's ready, we'll get it on the table. We'll continue having the discussion on what are we going to do about this year's dividend and capital budget. So just kind of stay flexible. We'll keep members posted. We'll try to keep a reasonable schedule and advance notice. We do have a couple members that may be gone Thursday, Friday, so we want to take that into consideration on our schedule also to make sure when we have the most critical decisions being made that the Finance Committee is full membership because we have a broad diversification around the state so everybody can get their 2 cents in. Senator Olson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senator Welikowski is supposed to be calling in. Was supposed to be calling in this afternoon, and for sure we'll be calling in tomorrow morning, and I'll try and call in as well as Friday if we're not back by then.
Okay, thank you. That'll be good. With that, I'll see everybody tomorrow. We are adjourned.